was that there was some pre-Big Bang period, some period before the radiation dominated Big Bang, where a different kind of dark energy dominated, some very large amount of dark energy, something that behaved like dark energy, causing the universe to accelerate and expansion, and that goes back earlier. And then waves emitted in that very, very early time would have been stretched to exponentially large scales, and then would be visible on the largest scales today. So, but as I see, they said they don't seem to exist yet.
As I mentioned, Maxwell's equations explained light and the speed of light, and also, of course, gave rise, when I wrote down that wave, I didn't tell you its wavelength, could have been anything, and so immediately you had an infinity of solutions describing waves of any wavelength. Actually, that's a fundamental feature of the theory. It has a symmetry, which is known as conformal symmetry, which is if you change length scales, the theory is invariant. And so Maxwell's theory has this beautiful deep symmetry, which so far has not been fully exploited in fundamental physics. We know it's a very important principle, but I would say we haven't succeeded yet in writing down a fundamental theory of physics which has that symmetry. And almost certainly, that is the direction the next big revolution in physics will come from. Let's try to identify the symmetries in Maxwell's theory. So this was critical to the invention of the theory of relativity. As I mentioned, in Newton's theory, Newton and Galileo were very much like Maxwell and Faraday. Galileo had the insight, and Newton just turned it into mathematics. Okay. Faraday had the insight, Maxwell turned it into mathematics. This interplay between experimentalists and theorists was incredibly important in the past. But as I mentioned, Newton and Galileo had both assumed that if two objects are moving and one catches up the other, then according to the second object, the first one will be moving more slowly. Just the obvious thing. And when you trace that back, that comes down to an invariance in Newton's equations, which is called Galilean invariance, that I can change my reference frame by moving to a frame which has constant velocity, and the law doesn't change. This invariance is no longer true in Maxwell's theory. It gets replaced with another invariance, and this new invariance has the property that it preserves the speed of light. And so it allows you to have an absolute speed, and when you do transformation, that speed remains fixed. So once Maxwell's equations were discovered, people started trying to understand their symmetry and what replaced Galilean symmetry. So Maxwell's have a lot of symmetry. They have translation invariance. Lorentz invariance, and conformal invariance. This is very fundamental. Um, It includes scale invariance. But I'm not going to talk about it much because this is really what I consider to be a modern frontier of research, to try to formulate the laws of physics so they don't involve any scale at all. Okay. If a theory is conformally invariant, it can't involve any scale. And if it doesn't involve any scale, then physics is no longer about units. It's about, for example, information. It's about something which doesn't have units. And that is still work in progress. We haven't managed to write all the laws of physics to be consistent with that symmetry. So we're going to focus on these two, and particularly this one, Lorentz invariance. And these symmetries connect space and time. That was the unusual feature of the Lorentz symmetries compared to Galilean symmetries. And it leads to all their sort of puzzling and at first sight paradoxical predictions. So to see Lorentz symmetry, we need to combine space and time into a single entity. And so we combine the coordinates on space, x, y, and z, if we have Cartesian coordinates, with time. And if we're going to combine objects into a single mathematical object, we better make the dimensions the same. And so we multiply by the speed of light to turn time into a variable with the same dimensions as space. And then we have d alpha, which is, of course, d by dx alpha, is equal to 1 over c d by dt and grad. So we're going to write down the equations as differential equations. And again, we want to combine space and time into a single four-component vector. So alpha goes from 0, 1, 2, 3. And so x0 is ct, xi is xi. And so on. So d0 is 1 over c dt, etc. So we're going to use Greek indices go from 0, 1, 2, 3, and Latin indices just go over space. Okay, that's the convention which I'll use. And then we're going to define a certain object called a metric, eta alpha beta, a very simple matrix, which is symmetrical matrix. And the only role of eta is to put a minus sign in the time direction. And this, as we'll see, this is important in order to get the Maxwell's equations correct. And in fact, you could say that the only difference between time and space is this minus sign. It's a very important difference, indeed, describes this minus sign is responsible for causal behavior in physics. It changes the equations of physics from parabolic equations would have all plus ones here, to hyperbolic. And hyperbolic means you have an initial value problem and you can propagate things forward in this time coordinate. So this minus sign is extremely fundamental and important. And the inverse, so it's very important when we're dealing with space-time indices, like alpha and beta, to note if they are raised or lowered. Okay, so from now on, we're going to keep track of whether the index is down or up very carefully. And the inverse is a matrix which looks like this, which is the same thing. Dots indicate zero. And of course, as usual with matrices, this guy is the row and the column. And this is the row and the column. And it's the inverse, so eta alpha beta, eta beta delta is delta alpha delta. So the matrix times its inverse gives the unit matrix, which is and in the case of the delta, we don't really need to be careful about the ordering of the indices, but this would be the row and the column. You'll notice that I've put this index on the left and down and the right and up. We'll have to be careful about such things in general. And if we look, so the first thing we might do with this eta is try to write the wave operator. Okay, so eta alpha beta d alpha d beta. And so the rule I'm following is to contract indices, one up with one down. This, it will turn out, will ensure that the quantity I'm talking about is invariant under the symmetry, which we will identify in shortly. But it's obvious that if I write down this object, this is the wave operator. This is minus 1 over c squared d by dt squared plus grad squared. Okay, so this is just an example of an interesting operator which I can express using these symbols. Notice that we can define a d alpha by raising, this is called raising an index. Okay, so the way I defined the derivative operator was with the downstairs index, but I can raise its index by multiplying with eta and summing over beta. And this all this will do is put the minus sign in front of the d by dt term. So this is minus 1 over c d by dt grad. Okay, so now we want to write Maxwell's equations. Can we simplify Maxwell's equations? And the first object we have to deal with are the fields. So is there anything I can do to combine these fields into a single object with Greek indices? Okay, so that's the rule of the game, is I want to simplify the Maxwell equations. Instead of writing d by dt and grad, I want to write this d alpha. Instead of writing electric and magnetic fields, I want to write down some object with only Greek indices. okay, which includes space and time together. So how could you combine two three-component vectors into an object made up with four indices? Yeah, somebody knows the answer. So these are six objects, right? You cannot combine them into, I don't know, let's imagine there was some field, I'll call it F, F alpha, that would have four components, right? I'm trying to fit six things in, which are independent. They don't fit into four. But if I do that, this now has 16 components, right? Four times four. But what I can do is impose antisymmetry. And then, of course, an antisymmetric four-component tensor. This is a two-index object. It's a matrix. So on the diagonal, it must be zero, because the diagonal elements are equal to minus themselves. So they must be zero. And then I have three non-zero components here. And of course, they're negatives. And then I have three more here. OK, so these are non-zero. And then we just have the negative of the same thing. And so you see you have six independent components of an antisymmetric two-index tensor. So this is an antisymmetric rank two tensor. And at least it has the right number of elements to include the electric and the magnetic fields. So that motivates us to write down F alpha beta, which is minus F beta alpha. And again, this index is the row, and this is the column. And so what we do is we put the electric field up here, minus Ex over C, minus Ey over C, minus Ez over C. And here we have Ex over C, Ey over C, Ez over C. And then the other three components I'll use for the magnetic field. So Bz minus By, Bx, and then the negative here, minus Bz, By, and minus Bx. OK, so at least, yes?
In the notes, there's a minus missing in 23 for this one. For the Bz, it's supposed to be a minus.
Oh, yes, it should be. Yeah, thanks. Top right corner should be a minus. Or I can write that as F0i. Zero is the row, I is the column, is minus Ei. And Fij is, there's an over C. Fij is epsilon ijk bk. IE. Now, having this object with two downstairs indices, we can easily raise the indices. Also, F alpha beta, which is eta alpha gamma, eta beta delta, F gamma delta. And this will turn out to be the only change is to change objects which have one time and one space indices. index because the time changes by a minor sign, but space does not. And so this gives us Ex over C, Ey over C, Ez over C. And then here we have just the same as before. Bz minus By, Bx, and the minus. So that was the tricky part. It took people 40 years. Okay. But of course, hindsight is a wonderful thing. But now we define the current, the forecurrent, J alpha, to be rho EC and J. Okay, again, this object, the current per unit area per unit time, has the same units as the charge density times C. You need this to get one over time in there, in the units. And it makes sense to combine those two things into the forecurrent, which I guess I've given a capital letter. So that's it. It turns out that Maxwell equations can be written or rewritten d alpha f alpha beta is minus mu naught j beta, and then d alpha f beta gamma plus, and this is just cycling the indices around, d gef alpha beta plus d beta f gamma alpha equals 0. And I'll just leave that as an exercise. So is it clear what you have to do? You have to just apply this d alpha operator, sum over the indices. And obviously, this equation is going to give the Maxwell, this one will give the Gauss law when the index is 0. When the index is I, you're going to get Ampere's law. And then this equation is going to give you the no monopoles and Faraday's law, because there's no current density here. Are there any questions? Your marks are proportional to how many questions you ask as a class. I'm only teasing.
About
the second one. There are no marks. What?
Second one is not obviously invariant, at least to me right now.
Right. Okay. I haven't even talked about the invariance at all. I've just motivated some language to rewrite it as this. So let's now discuss. Are we going to? Yeah. Momentarily, we'll discuss the invariance. All I've done is a little bit of algebra. You could say, this is a cute trick. I've reduced four equations to two. Right? That's all I've done. But the cute trick will allow us to see the symmetry, and we'll discuss the symmetry momentarily. Before we do that, we can re-express, so let's now call this 1 and 2. We can further simplify 2. By introducing epsilon. Okay, so you know from your math courses that this epsilon ijk and delta ij are the only invariant tensors under rotations in three dimensions. These are tensors which, when you operate on them with rotations, remain unchanged. So they're very natural objects to have if you have rotation symmetry around. We are going to have something like rotation symmetry, but it's going to involve space and time, and it'll involve all these four indices. So it's very natural to introduce this epsilon guy. And this is defined to be 1 if alpha, beta, gamma, delta is an even permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3, and minus 1 if it's an odd permutation, and 0 otherwise. Okay, so just to make that a little bit more graphic, let's say, so for 0, 1, 2, 3, the object is plus 1. Now imagine I do some random permutation. Okay, so let's write down 3, 1, 2, let's do 3, some random permutation. Okay, I want to know if it's even or odd. Okay, even or odd means how many pair flips did I need to do to go from here to there? Right? A permutation is where I take two neighboring indices and I reverse them. So how many of those do I need? Well, it's easy to see because I join the 1 to the 1, the 2 to the 2, the 3 to the 3, the 0 to the 0. And is that odd or even? See, every time I do a flip, I'm going to cross two wires. Okay. And so I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's an even permutation, right? So you can see that this one would be plus 1, and that would be plus 1. And if there's an odd number of crossings in the wires, it's minus 1. So that's the definition of the epsilon symbol. And now you can rewrite 2 as follows. 2 is then epsilon alpha beta gamma delta d beta f gamma delta. Okay, may not be obvious that this equation and that are equivalent. How do you show they're equivalent? Well, the only free index here is alpha. So let's pick alpha to be 0. Okay, and then this must be 1, 2, 3, or some permutation. So clearly I have d1, f2, 3, plus d2, f3, 1, etc. I have 3 permutations. Actually, you might think it's 6, but this is antisymmetric, so there are really only 3 terms, and they will be exactly these 3 terms. Okay, so you can just check that by picking alpha to be 0, or 1, or 2, or 3. And so if alpha equals 0, we get no monopoles. Okay, because if alpha equals 0, then this only involves spatial derivatives, and I get di f. Epsilon ijk di fjk. But you know fjk is epsilon times b, and all you get out of this is div b equals 0. And alpha equals I gives Faraday. So actually, we can now, having simplified the equations, we can derive that there are waves satisfying these equations by by just taking the divergence. So if I take d alpha of equation 2, if j equals 0, if j beta equals 0, there are no currents or charges, take d alpha of this equation, you see from this equation d alpha f alpha beta is 0. So if I take d alpha here, when I get d alpha f alpha beta, I'll get 0. And d alpha f gamma alpha will be 0. And so the only term will be here. And so I get just using 1, I get d alpha f beta gamma equals 0. And that's the wave equation. OK. Now, actually, because of this equation, F beta gamma delta d beta f gamma delta equals 0. This equation implies, by something called Poincaré's lemma, that f alpha beta can be written as in terms of a vector potential. F alpha beta equals d alpha a beta minus d beta a alpha. Okay, to see that if I write an f like this, I can then this follows is not difficult. So just put this expression into here, and you'll see the partial derivatives now involve let me write it in the same indices, gamma, delta, gamma. So if I just plug this into here, you'll see the first terms involves d beta, d gamma, which is symmetric under beta and gamma, but I've got my epsilon, which is anti-symmetric. So that'll give 0. And this one involves d beta, d delta, which is similarly 0. What Poincaré showed is that if you have such an equation, which is roughly speaking that the curl of something is 0, then it implies that the something can be written as a gradient. I won't prove that. A caveat to this is that it's only possible locally. Usually one doesn't have to worry about that because space-time is usually taken to be a simple manifold with no holes in it. But if it has holes in it, then there are caveats. And you have to be a little bit careful that this expression may not be true globally. OK, so this equation is very important. It allows us to write the field tensor, F alpha beta, in terms of a vector potential. And so we define this object, phi over C A, And so A mu with the lower index is minus phi over C A. And then we find that B is curl A, and E is minus grad phi, minus d by dt of A, which are, of course, the usual expressions in electrodynamics. Oops, wrong way. Oh, that one's bust. Apologies, that one needs fixing. I'll just leave it there. So notice that the vector, let's call it the four vector potential, A mu is not unique. If we replace A mu then F mu nu goes to F mu nu prime, which is F mu nu plus, and then this guy gives me d mu d nu chi minus d mu chi, which is F mu nu, because partial derivatives commute. So in other words, you can replace the vector potential with another vector, this vector potential with another one defined this way, and you get exactly the same field strength. And if the only physical thing in the theory is the field strength, and that's the way Maxwell defined it, purely in terms of the field strength, it means that the A mu has some redundancy. And this is of course, gauge invariance. This is another symmetry of Maxwell's equations. Okay, it's not, it's only a symmetry of the equations if we decide to express them in terms of the A mu. The A mu has this redundancy. But so you see, Maxwell's equations had translation invariance, which I guess wasn't a big surprise. But they if you do a physics experiment over here, over there, you expect to get the same answer. If I do it today or tomorrow, I expect to get the same answer. So that's what translation invariance means. It has Lorentz invariance, which we're going to deal with in a moment, which is the generalization of rotations. It has scale invariance, conformal invariance. You can rescale all lengths. And it also has the Sage invariance. Now, if you ask what were the fundamental principles which governed physics in the 20th century, that was it. They were all there in Maxwell's theory. So it really was the seed of the whole of 20th century physics. You may say, I haven't mentioned quantum mechanics, but of course it was the seed of quantum mechanics as well, because there was a contradiction between Maxwell's theory and the theory of heat, which led directly to the discovery of quantum mechanics. So Maxwell's theory is kind of the origin of everything, all of 20th century physics. Okay, so now we are ready to discuss Lorentz invariance. Okay, so we have reduced electrodynamics to the alpha F alpha beta is minus mu naught J beta and epsilon alpha beta gamma delta d beta f gamma delta equals zero. These deliberately are tensor equations. So tensor equations just mean you make everything out of matrices with indices, and then when you contract indices, you do it in a very specific way. And so when I reduce the tensor from rank 2 or 2 index tensor down to 1, I do it by contracting with some object with 1 index, and I always contract an upstairs and downstairs index together. Constructed by contracting indices in a very specific way. Upstairs with downstairs. Contracting means the same as summing over two indices. So let us just compare classical mechanics where we write the equations as x double dot mx double dot is minus gradient v, for example. Okay, so f equals ma, if the force is due to a potential, we write the equations this way. This is invariant, under rotations. Okay, what does that mean? A rotation means that vector x goes to vector x prime is Ox, where O is a with O transpose O equals 1. That's an orthogonal matrix. And it follows that minus the gradient of V in the new coordinates is just equal to minus O inverse transpose gradient V is minus O grad V. And so the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this equation transform identically under coordinate transformations. And so what that means is that mx prime double dot is minus grad prime v. So the equation is still true in a rotated coordinate system. And so what we say is that the equations are invariant under rotations. It just means that if you take a system and you rotate it around, it still satisfies the same equation. In order for that to be true, the left and right hand side have to be a tensor. They have to have, in order for it to be a sensible equation, they have to have the same number of indices, and they have to transform in the same way under these rotations. So in electrodynamics, the situation is very similar with these equations. In that we're allowed to do rotations of the space-time coordinates. So in electrodynamics, we can rotate the space-time coordinate and what we do is set x prime alpha to be lambda alpha beta x beta. Again, being careful about upstairs and downstairs indices, where lambda is a 4x4 matrix. And we're going to impose some conditions on lambda in a moment. This, of course, implies that d alpha is dx prime beta dx alpha d by dx prime beta by the usual chain rule of differentiation. And then this is lambda beta alpha d beta d prime beta. Okay, so derivatives transform like this. They transform with, they have a lower index. Coordinates have a raised index. And this implies that d beta, or I can invert this matrix to express d prime alpha in terms of d beta. And I need this equation, beta alpha d beta. Okay, where lambda twiddle is the inverse of lambda. So we define the inverse to satisfy this equation. lambda alpha beta lambda twiddle beta gamma is delta alpha gamma, and that's the same as lambda beta gamma lambda twiddle alpha beta. Okay, so if I, maybe I'll put the lambda over here, lambda beta gamma. So if I multiply on the right with lambda twiddle, I get the identity matrix, or if I multiply on the left, I get the identity matrix. Okay, so coordinates transform using lambda. Derivatives transform using lambda twiddle. And in general, upstairs quantities will go like lambda, and downstairs quantities will go like the inverse, lambda twiddle. Now you can already see that in my equations, I've contracted an upstairs index with a downstairs index. And so the way the downstairs guy will transform with lambda twiddle, upstairs with lambda, because the two are inverses, the lambdas will disappear, and the equations will be invariant. OK, so let's see that in more detail. So upstairs things, so four vectors with upstairs indices, and these are called contravariant vectors. Transform like this, like the coordinates, x, lambda, alpha, beta, j, beta, and four vectors with downstairs indices. Which are called covariant vectors, transform using lambda twiddle. D alpha prime is lambda twiddle, alpha beta d beta. If you want to remember these words, trees grow up and valleys go down. Okay, but you don't really need to remember that. You don't need the jargon. Just remember upstairs and downstairs indices are different kinds of objects. And so, let's see, maybe I can... So F prime alpha beta. So how do you think this transforms? How should F transform? It has two indices. So what do I do? Pardon? Just throw two lambdas at it, right? So lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta F gamma delta, right? And if I have an F with downstairs indices, I'm going to use lambda twiddle. And what about the epsilon symbol? Okay, so this is epsilon. This is going to be epsilon, let's call it chi psi eta xi lambda alpha beta gamma delta chi psi eta xi. And that, by the way, is the definition of the determinant of lambda, right? This is equal to epsilon alpha beta gamma delta determinant of lambda. It's another way of defining the determinant.
Isn't the only reason that it kind of makes sense to write down that upper equation just like your notation?
Yes.
So is that an equation you're going to go test in the lab?
Yes. Yes. Yes, you can test Lorentz invariants in the lab. So, but yeah, I'm just doing algebra. I'm just fiddling around with the equations, trying to identify some symmetry. That's all I'm doing. At the end of the day, we have to check it in the lab. And this is one of the most precisely tested facts about physics, that it is Lorentz invariant. Most important. Most important is that when we wrote down these equations here, we have used eta, right? I used that eta symbol to define this f from that f. Okay? The relationship between the downstairs f and the upstairs f was defined using eta. Most important, eta is used in the equations to define f alpha beta in terms of f alpha beta. So we must insist that eta is invariant. Which means that eta prime alpha beta, which is lambda alpha gamma lambda beta delta eta gamma delta, is equal to eta alpha beta. Right, that matrix eta is minus 1, 1, 1, 1, always. In any system of coordinates, it has to equal minus 1. And this, in fact, is the defining equation of the Lorentz transformations. Okay, but lambda has to be a matrix which preserves this relation, preserves eta, and let's come over here. So if I write this as a matrix equation, it reads lambda eta lambda transpose equals eta. Why is that lambda transpose? Well, you see, this is the row column. And so here what I'm doing is I'm contracting a column with the column index. So that's not how the matrix product works. The matrix product works by contracting the column of this matrix with the row of that matrix. So if I transpose the matrix, I flip the columns and the row, and this is how the equation reads in sort of without indices, just written as a matrix. And now I can take the determinant of both sides. When you take the determinant of a product of matrices, you get the product of determinants. Okay? And so that gives you det lambda transpose, det eta equals det eta. And det lambda transpose is just det lambda. Determinant doesn't change when you transpose a matrix. And so this implies that det lambda squared equals 1, which implies that det lambda equals plus or minus 1. So the Lorentz transformations split into two pieces. Those with det lambda equals 1, which includes the identity, the identity transformation is just lambda alpha beta is delta alpha beta. That's a legitimate transformation. And those with det lambda equals minus 1. So we will mostly focus on this part. This is the connected component. This is called the connected component. Connected means it's smoothly connected to the identity. Okay, so we have this big symmetry of Maxwell's equations under which CTx prime is lambda times CTx. Right? If I write it as a matrix equation, then I can mix up space and time. We can easily find a simple example, e.g., let's consider our lambda to only include, to be identity, except in these in this upper corner. So it only mixes x with t, or with ct, and so let's call this M. And then we must have that M times this matrix times M transpose should equal this. Okay, so it's kind of an orthogonal matrix. The only, if this factor was 1, it would be an orthogonal matrix. We know what the orthogonal matrix is. The orthogonal matrix looks like cos theta. So compared to the orthogonal matrix, which is cos theta, minus sine theta, cos theta. OK, this satisfies O transpose O is 1. The only difference this minus sign makes is that here we get M is equal to cosh theta, sinh theta cosh theta. No minus sign, as in here. We can check that easily enough. If I do CSSC minus 1, 1 times CSSC, right? Then this matrix times that gives me first row times the first column gives me minus C. Then over here I get S. This times this gives minus S. This times this gives C. Now I multiply this matrix by that matrix, and I get minus C squared plus S squared in this term. From here I get minus CS plus CS, so I get 0. I get 0. And then this times this gives me c squared minus s squared. But c is cos theta and s is sinh theta. So this is minus 1, 1, 0, 0. And so these are the Lorentz transformations. And they are responsible for all of the effects in special relativity. Okay, so in particular, I've got CT prime would be cosh theta CT plus sinh theta x, and x prime is cosh theta x plus theta CT. And usually we write that as gamma CT plus VX, gamma CT, sorry, X plus CT. Where sinh, I should put, got to get the units right. Units aren't right here. This is a length. This is V over C. So sinh theta is gamma V over C, and cosh theta is gamma. And it follows that gamma is 1 over square root 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop there. We've discussed electrodynamics. We've discussed its symmetries. It should be clear these are extremely powerful symmetries. For example, if I take my field strength to be purely an electric field in one coordinate system, and I go to another coordinate system, I'm going to get some non-zero magnetic field because I'll rotate that tensor into the magnetic components. And so electric and magnetic fields get transformed into each other depending on your coordinate system. What we're going to do next time is discuss how these transformation laws affect the laws of mechanics, how we revise Newton's theory of mechanics to be consistent with this symmetry. So the philosophy is to say Maxwell's theory must be more fundamental than Newton. It has much more symmetry. It's much more beautiful, much more powerful. So let's use Maxwell's theory and its symmetry as a guide to how we should reconstruct the laws of mechanics. And so we'll do that next time, and we'll derive formula E equals mc squared and show how particles are affected by forces in mechanics, which is consistent with the Lorentz transformations. So then any questions for today? Yeah.
So from the hyperbolic angles, what tells us that we can write it in terms of?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's more or less just algebra, okay? You see, what I'm saying here is I can write that as cosh theta ct plus tanh theta x. That's an identity. And now I say, well, what does this tanh mean? Okay. Well, first of all, I can rewrite it in terms of v over c, where v is a velocity less than speed of light, where v is less than c, because tanh is always less than 1. Okay. So I can rewrite these equations like this, where v is less than c. So I've just traded one parameter for another. I've traded theta, which I didn't really know what it meant physically, into a v. Now, then I would claim it's actually obvious what this means physically, what the v means, because we, if you look, well, it's only obvious if I write it correctly. Sorry, there should be a v here, right? Not a c. And just by the same argument, this is the sinh theta is v over c, and so tanh theta is v over c. From here, what does this mean? It means that in the new coordinate system, a particle which was at x equals 0 for all time. So I had a particle which is, so here is x and ct. A particle which was sitting at 0 for all time just moves up this axis, right? Now I go to the new coordinate system. Well, the x prime for that particle is gamma vt, okay? And so obviously the, so the particle in the new coordinate system is certainly moving. I mean, as t progresses, the old coordinate progresses, this x prime is changing. Now, actually, you can ask yourself a question, for which value of x at each t time t would my x prime not be moving? Okay, that by definition is the origin in the x prime coordinate system. And it's easy to tell that that's where x is minus vt. So if x is minus vt, that's a trajectory like this. X equals minus vt, right? And this is the location of x prime equals 0. So actually, it's probably a little easier to picture if I choose minus signs. I should be able to do it. Okay, so this is x prime equals 0. So if x prime equals 0, that's fine. So basically, this is the t prime axis. You see, this is ct prime, because by definition, the ct prime axis is the locus of points which all have x prime equals 0. What about the x prime axis? Well, the x prime axis is the locus of points where ct prime would be 0. So if ct prime is 0, then I have this equation, which is x equals minus c squared over v t. And I think, or equivalently, t is minus v over c squared v over c squared x. And so, or ct is minus v over cx. Okay, so that's basically saying that's this axis, right? So this would be the x prime axis. Okay, so basically these Lorentz transformations they're not rotations. In fact, the one thing they do is they leave this line invariant. So if you take these two axes and you just open them or close them, that's, you get this new coordinate system, okay? And so here are the lines of constant x prime. These are the lines of constant ct prime. These are my new coordinates on space-time. Okay, and then the interpretation of V is now very easy. It just says that if I'm an observer, if the original observer uses the coordinates x and ct, the new observer uses these coordinates. Well, this observer is moving at a speed minus v in the original coordinate system, okay? Because the new observer's locus in the original coordinate system is x equals minus vt, okay? Where v is less than the speed of light. So it's rather straightforward to go from these abstract angles to the physical interpretation of the coordinate, which is just that the new observer is moving relative to the original one. Any other? Yeah?
Could you please expand on why eta has to be invariant?
Well, as I said,
the equations are invariant.
Yes, okay. So one way of saying it, you see, if I write the equations, so here, this equation, right? Now, what do? I want to be, if it's invariant, it must be true that if I prime everything, it's still true, right? Now, that's fine. This equation is invariant if x prime alpha is lambda alpha beta x beta, and by definition, things with downstairs indices transform in this way. I'm getting it all wrong. Beta. Okay, providing this is the inverse of that. This one is invariant. Nothing else to say. Lambda could be anything, as long as lambda twiddle is its inverse. This equation is invariant. All right? Now, the problem is we've got this other equation, which involves f with downstairs indices. But what is f gamma delta? It's actually eta gamma, you know, in terms of this guy, psi eta delta chi f psi chi. All right? So if I stick to this definition, you know, this one object, that's the definition of the second equation. But that must also have this to be true. So now I prime everything, means in the new coordinate system, this must be true. That's what it means for it to be invariant. Okay? So this guy is going to transform with the lambda, and then the eta is going to transform as a tensor in order for this to be true. I must have eta prime gamma psi equals lambda gamma psi alpha beta eta alpha beta. That's fine. Okay, but actually, I want this equation to be true with eta equal to minus 1, 1, 1, 1. It must be equal to eta gamma psi. Otherwise, I'll have some new object floating around that is different in different coordinate systems. Okay, so by insisting that the equations are valid in all of these coordinate systems, you, with eta being defined the same in all coordinate systems and epsilon defined the same in all coordinate systems, actually you impose these conditions. These conditions here, that lambda, eta, you impose this condition that lambda, eta, lambda transpose equals eta. Okay? So essentially it's because you don't want to introduce a new coordinate-dependent quantity. Eta has to be the same in all coordinate systems. Okay? And that's what imposes this condition on Lorentz transformations. Yeah.
You say that eta has to be the same. Why it has to be?
I want the equations to be valid in any coordinate system.
Okay.
That's my definition of a symmetry.
Yeah,
it is only a symmetry.
With that same eta, but why do you want
yes.
it to be valid with the same eta? Why can everything transform except eta?
Because if eta transformed, if
you make a trivial statement, like that
yes,
any
correct.
Physics contains.
You see, if eta transformed, I don't have any equations to determine eta. What is eta?
From Lorentz invariance.
No, demanding eta is the same in any coordinate system is the same as demanding Lorentz invariance. So when I write down my equations in this form, right? What I'm saying is I want these equations to be true in any coordinate system where eta is minus plus 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 always. Okay? And the same for epsilon. I don't want those guys to transform. That is the principle which you impose. So if you like, it's saying that the metric on space-time, the quantity you use to measure distances on space-time, is one insists that this is invariant under changes of coordinates. The same statement with rotations, the metric on space-time is just the Pythagoras rule. The distance between two points is x1 minus x2 squared. Okay, that does not change if I do a rotation. So rotations can be defined as the set of operations which do not change lengths. Eta defines a length on space-time. Okay, we'll use that next time. So if I have two points, let's say x1 alpha and x2 alpha, two points in space-time, and I take the separation between them. Okay, and I want to define a distance, somehow a distance, right? So what I do is generalize Pythagoras to this, and this is the invariant, the Lorentz invariant distance. That's where the word metric comes from. So when you measure distance, it's like the meter. I'm measuring how far. And so eta gives you a way to define distances which are Lorentz invariant. And it's insisting that this metric, the way I measure distances, is the same, no matter which coordinate system I use, that gives, that defines Lorentz transformations and special relativity. So, if only Maxwell's equations had not used eta, then we wouldn't have this constraint. It's because when you construct the equations, you needed that eta to get the signs right. Okay, and insisting it's always the same eta is what forces you to Lorentz transformations. Any other questions? Good. All right. So I'll see you tomorrow at 9 a.m. Is there a class this afternoon?
Yes.
And so it's a problem-solving class?
It's a problem-solving, and we're going to try to demonstrate that as prime, like if Nate asks the question, how can we do that in the lab? And we'll have a pair of plates.
Okay. Excellent.
And then we'll actually see it in the lab.
Great. So you're going to see the transformation of electric into magnetic fields.
Yeah.
You can't overemphasize how mind-blowing this was at the time. People thought electric and magnetic fields are different things. This says no, they're both facets of one object, the field strength tensor, and they can be different in different coordinate systems. What time is the class? 3:15 is the class. Okay, I'll drop in if you want to ask any more questions.